God, let me get a look at you. Wow. You know, it's going to seem redundant, but I just, because of what I want to talk about tonight, I want to find out a little bit about who's in the room. First of all, let me explain the Tom too. Okay, this came about very late in my program, where I kept showing up in rooms, and because there were so many people in my demographic, which would be born between 1950 and 1970, there seemed to be a lot of Toms. And so I'd always find myself being second Tom. And so I just started saying Tom too. And then I started thinking, oh, well, it could be Tom too, as in Tom also. And then I started thinking all kinds of things about Tom too. And then I thought, oh, it could be like, you know, those of you who are old enough, remember Secondhand Rose, you know? Yeah, well, you're gonna hear my story. I was number 5 out of 6. So you know when I got something new. Yeah, when I got enough those nickel Coke bottles and returned them, I could buy something new on my own. Otherwise, I got nothing new. So then I thought, ooh, this is like, you know, I should marry Secondhand Rose. I'm Tom too. But then I also landed on this other wonderful little Tom too that I happened to be in Florida, and I happened to go to a museum. It was a pirate museum. And there is this pirate whose name was Tom too, T-E-W, Tom too. And I thought, wow, I kind of like that idea, Tom too. And of course, he's historically famous because his is the only pirate's chest that we still have intact with the looty and booty still in it. So you can actually see this treasure chest there. So then for about a New York second, I adopted this Tom T-E-W too, the spiritual pirate, I steal your program, and I take everything I can get and put it in my little treasure chest, my little God chest. That has gone away, and as you can see, we were billed tonight as Tom too, T-O-O. How many other Toms do we have in the room? Any others? I rest my case, okay? That is great. I love you people. You know, it'll be a little redundant what I want to do here, but I want to get to know a little bit about you because I'm going to speak specifically to certain groups of you. If you've been in the program between 1 and 10 years only, if you've been more than 10, don't raise your hand. Raise your hand if you've been in between 1 and 10. I want to see what the... Okay, that's like about 2/3 of the group. Okay. If you've been in between 10 and 20, raise your hands. Oh, that's a still pretty good-sized group. Okay, between 20 and 30... Wow, okay, they're my peeps, 20 and 30. 30 to 40, wow. You guys, I'm gonna step off and let you come up here in a little bit, okay? 40 to 50, no? Bill and Lois have left the house, I guess, okay. All right, so we have nobody over 40 years. The reason why I wanted to do this was because I remember when I first came into the program, and I'll tell you really briefly my history, the biography, and then I'll tell you a little bit about, but really what I want to talk to you tonight about is rather than me coming up here and just sharing my story, I always wanted to hear about somebody, you know, what did they actually learn while they were here? And that's sort of what we tell anyway, but I want to frame it that way because when I first got here, about 25, 26 years ago, I didn't take a chip tonight, but I probably will maybe on one of the next ones. I remember I'd hear people say they've been in the program for 20 years, 30 years, you know, and if those of you remember when you were first new and I kept thinking, you've been here for 20 years? I mean, you didn't get it after 20 years? I mean, 30 years you've been here? 40 years you've been here, 40. I'm going like, what the hell are you doing for 40 years? Please tell me I'm going to get better. And please tell me I'm not going to be here in 40 years. But I'm happy to tell you I'm here in 25. And God willing, I will be here in 40. You're making me verklempt already. And so I always wanted to hear, what the hell do you learn over a 30, 40 year period of time? So here's what I'm going to share with you. I figured for when I'm asked to speak, it's time for Tom too to share what he's learned. I'm kind of look at this as you're now, I'm coming to the principal and I'm telling you, okay, you sent me on this journey. You wanted me to learn some stuff. Here's what I learned. So before I even begin though, I like to collect Al-Anon prayers. So I'm going to start with this one as my little disclaimer for this. God, I offer myself to you. To build with me and do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of myself that I may better do our work. Take away my difficulties that victory over them bears witness to those who I would help with a higher power. Your love and way of life, I do always. I love collecting the prayers. You can find many of them on the internet. I share them in groups regularly. As you can see, you know, I will tell you one of the things I learned after 25 years in the program, and this one was just really new. It stunned me one day when I finally heard, you know, that we pray only for God's will. And I thought, shit, I've been praying for everything but God's will for 20, 25 years. I prayed for everything. I prayed they'd stop drinking. I prayed that the sky wouldn't fall. I prayed that you-know-who wouldn't be president. I mean, I prayed for everything, right? And then I'm hearing, we pray only for God's will and the strength to carry that out. That took me 20 freaking years to learn. I wish I'd learned that in the first year. First year, people, pray only for God's will and the strength to carry it out. Okay, this is not advice. That's the other thing. First of all, let me apologize. I get excited about what I've learned. And it sounds like advice. It's not advice. This is my program and only my program. So that's my disclaimer. I want to make sure you do not think this is advice, even if it sorts of sounds like advice. I'm trying really not to give advice. So here's what I've learned. Here, I want to first give you the history. Here's what Tom Tu's history is, so you can understand, you know, the life that has brought me to this point. I consider myself a major survivor. At this point in my life, about a couple months ago, I lost my best friend of 50 years, who I had done Head Start with when it first started in 1968. So those of you old enough to remember Head Start, I was one of those socialist communist, you know, Head Start guys in the 60s. They used to call me Chairman Mao, you know. That's what they called me because I was in the Deep South at that time. And trust me, if you cared about another person, you were communist there, you know. Anybody besides your own family, that's for dang sure. But anyway, here's my brief summary. I tried to write it down so I could go quickly so I could get to these things you learned throughout the program. And I got to make sure I set my timer here because otherwise I will not be as much as I would like to be. So here we go. Okay, as I shared with you, I'm born in the 50s. I was from a mixed family in the Deep South. Now, in the 1950s, a mixed family in the Deep South was not a black-white marriage because that was illegal. This was before loving, right? Loving, not the verb, but yes, loving the verb, but also loving the court case that even made that legal. At that time, a mixed marriage meant one was Catholic and the other one was Protestant. And you know which one I was raised in, because at that time, if you had a Catholic-Protestant marriage, the children had to be raised Catholic. So I was raised Catholic my entire life. I came from a nauseatingly Catholic family, Catholic school my whole life, set of twins, station wagon. I was number 5 out of 6 in a huge Catholic family, and one side Catholic, the other side UCC, which is sort of a Lutheran kind of thing. And both of my parents were number 5 out of 6. So you know how many cousins I have. You go to Reading, Pennsylvania, open the phone book, and it's all my cousins on both sides. Half the population is directly related to me in Reading, Pennsylvania. I'm Pennsylvania Dutch by lineage. I was the 5th child out of 6. I was born in the North, and in first grade, my family moved me to the Deep South. So I'm a Catholic. I'm in Pennsylvania Dutch country. There's Amish people. I'm in this German Catholic community, and suddenly I'm showing up. I'm in the South, and there's the signs. We serve the white public only. We reserve the right to refuse service. And of course, the subtlety of the xenophobia in the South at that time was staggering, because it wasn't just white-black. It was also many other things. It was Jewish oppression. It was definitely gay oppression. I mean, it was like, and you know, don't even get me started on the misogyny there. You know, this was a really volatile place to grow up in 1959 in the Deep South. Saw KKK rallies, went to Catholic school my whole life. And this wasn't the apartheid South at the time. I went to a high school, which was the first high school in the state of Virginia. And when I graduated, my class was the first class to graduate together where for 4 years we went together as black and white students because it was legally mandated that we were going to integrate the schools. So I graduated in 1971, first time in the history of the state of Virginia that there's an integrated class, that blacks and whites could be graduated together as one family. Amazing. So what does Tom Tu do? The one who they call Chairman Mao? I decide I'm going to a junior college because I can't afford, you know, four-year school. Even at that time, I couldn't afford it. So I went to a junior college, and at the end of the two-year junior college, I had two choices. One, I could go to William & Mary, which was just a fabulous school, which I couldn't afford. And there was one school that was in the community next to me. It was called Virginia State College at that time. It's now called Virginia State University. Does anybody know about Virginia State University? Virginia State University is one of the United Negro College schools. I went to school for 3 years in an African-American college where I was the only white person in my environment for 3 years. There was one white professor I had in 3 years of studies there and not one other white student. That's how apartheid the South was in the 1970s when I was there. Yeah, amazing time. I survived that, but boy, I learned a doctorate degree on culture and racism, like you cannot imagine. Following that, though, guess what? God does some wonderful things, my will and God's will. That's one of my other favorite things to talk about. My will was, of course, I was going to be a rock star, and I was going to have this great career, and I was a musician, and I studied music at Virginia State University, and I'm realizing Tom too is gay. Not too many gay rock stars, Freddie Mercury aside. You know? It's kind of a little, you know, and I'm in the Deep South. I'm gay. I'm in a black school. They call me Chairman Mao. I'm going, woo, Tom Tu's life is looking a little scary here. So, of course, I'll cut to the chase. A couple things happened in between. But you know what Tom Tu had to do? Tom Tu had to get in a car and just drive. He just drove to California. Because what I found is when I was there, I didn't really resonate with the people who were there. They were so not like me. And then I got to California, I went to Southern California. I'm in Burbank, California. And all of a sudden I'm surrounded by all these wonderful, wacky people in California. And I'm going, wow, I'm just like them. And so this is great. And of course I'm gay and I'm in LA at the time. But then God has a funny way of suddenly waking you up. Then AIDS hits. It's 1981, 82. I survived that. But pretty much every one of my friends did not. That was a tough time. Yeah. So, Tom Tu survives that. Tom Tu survives the Deep South in 1959. Tom Tu survives being number 5 out of 6 in a Catholic family. And Tom Tu is now doing just fine working at Bullock's department stores. Those of you who are old enough to know it. Tom Tu was a rock star at Bullock's department stores, man. And I spent 30, 35 years in working there. Ladies, I spent 10 years in women's shoes. And no, I don't do drag. But I spent those 10 years. I know more about your shoes than you do. And I have more of them than you do. I do. I became a rock star at Bullock's. I was a great sales manager. I managed diverse kids. I learned about addiction. I learned about people's differences. I had Jews, Muslims, gay people. I had transgenders way before they were cool on my staff. Way before they were cool. And I learned about people. Then I went into leadership development 25 years ago. I learned a lot about leadership development. In the middle of it, I went through not one, but two heavy relationships. One, I actually have been in now for 27 years. Yeah, 27 years. And of course, you know, true to fashion, I'm an Al-Anon, so what do I attract? Oh man, any of you who know my favorite MERP, Minnie Pearl? Oh, I love alcoholics. I love alcoholics. I love drug addicts. I love sex addicts. I mean, come on. You know, we're Al-Anons. We love these people. We do. And let me tell you, they're pretty good. They can smell an Al-Anon and they're glum right onto you. They do. 27 years later, I'm still glummed. But I have a very happy relationship. Challenging, but happy. But in that relationship, that's how I got in this program. I was in couples counseling because I wasn't sure I was going to make it. I'm watching my time. So the therapist says, Tom, you need to go to Al-Anon. And I've heard about Al-Anon. I know Al-Anon. I've been to Al-Anon. I don't need Al-Anon. I don't need Tom, you're in therapy. You're going to Al-Anon. I said, okay, I'll go. So I went. So I went to my first meeting. I walked in. That was the one where there are 20, 30, 40-year people. And I'm like, oh, yeah. But I heard some stuff in there that I thought, I'm starting to resonate with these people. So I went back and I told the therapist, I went, I can see why you wanted me to go. Yep, I got it. He says, you're going back again. I said, okay, so I went back again. Second time I went, and of course at that point I was in the, I'm going to fix them stage, very much fix them. But I was also, the other thing I want to share with you here is when I got into there, I had been so bruised from just life in general. And I had gotten to the point where I didn't feel like I could trust anyone. I couldn't trust my spouse. I felt like I couldn't trust my family because my family was split. I mean, to this day, I say it just makes me grieve that my mother and father could never truly love me because they could never really know me because they couldn't get beyond my orientation. So it's sad to me, but I've forgiven them. And because I love them now, we can all be whole. And they passed on at this point, and they know, it's great. I'm telling you, my dad would be so proud of me, at this moment. And I spent, after all those years, dealing with all these other issues, I dealt with that issue, I get into this relationship, and then I'm in couples counseling, and I'm thinking, okay, where are the couples that have been together a long time in this community? And there's not a whole lot of them, because first of all, a bunch of them died, and then, the ones that were there, not too long. So I kept looking for these couples that had been together, 15, 20, 25 years, and there were a few that I would know. But eventually, after at the 25th anniversary, I looked around and I said, crap, we're the role models. I mean, this is pretty pitiful if we're the role models. But the reality is we are the role models because it's ugly. Love is ugly. It's beautiful, but it's ugly. It's tough. It's tough stuff, loving. Romance is great. Love is difficult. You want to love? You got to be in rooms like this. Here's where you learn to love. You people taught me to love, and that's what I'm going to end with at the end of this. Okay, so I moved to California. I went through the 60s, Vietnam, Woodstock, segregation, Vatican II. Any of my Catholic friends in here? Vatican II, we were going to have female priests in the 70s at that point. Yeah, well, boy, are we far away from that. Things go on. So then I worked in retail, as I told you, 30, 35 years. And then I went through the dot-coms. I went through all this. And then I ended up working. And now, of course, I work for a company that it's my job to do conscious culture and conscious leadership. I'd like pinch myself. It's very hard work. But I'm like, on what I have learned in this program is so informs the work I do in leadership around consciousness. Because this is the ultimate holistic program. What we do with each other is we make each other whole. That's what we do. It's an amazing thing. And you have made me whole. As I have told you, I came into these rooms, I felt so depleted. I felt so, to the point where I couldn't trust anyone. I had given up on humanity. I just thought people just frankly suck. It's like, I can't stand, is there anybody in this world who is really honest anymore? And then my therapist says, go to Al-Anon. And I walk in, and what's the first thing I see? I see brutal honesty. I see vulnerability like I've never seen. I've seen authenticity and credibility that made me challenge that thought that the world was not, there wasn't people around that you could trust anymore, And that restored to me that. Now, of course, let me go through now what I can very briefly in about the next 5 to 10 minutes. What did Tom Tu learn from you people in the first 10 years, the second 10 years, and now in the third 10 years? Now, I'm not going to do a deep dive into these. I'm just going to give you the themes. Think of this as I'm going to give you the greatest hits and only the chorus. It's the way this is, okay? In the first 10 years, you restored to me a higher power. That orthodox religion that I came from had destroyed the higher power I had, because that higher power, I was told, didn't love me. And I was also told by everybody, including my family members and my parents, the same thing, right? In here, I learned that we all have a higher power, and we all get to have that higher power. Now, it took me about 3 or 4 years, and I finally had some wonderful member, God knows, I wish they were in here tonight, that said to me in a meeting, now again, may all of you who've been here in this program long enough, know that sometimes you don't hear things the first time it's said to you. Sometimes you don't hear it 100 times after it's been said to you. So after about 1,000 times when it was said to me, somebody came up to me in about my 4th or 5th year when they kept hearing me run on about the higher power. I was like, I don't get this higher power stuff. And I said, Tom, do you think you're the most powerful thing in the universe? I said, well, no. You got a higher power. Figure it out. That is this program. That is wisdom. That's credibility. That's authenticity. That indeed is God and a higher power speaking to you and waiting for that moment when you can hear it. Because I could not have heard that in the first 3 or 4 years. Because what I would have heard then was, oh, yeah, right. That night, I woke up. First 10 years, I learned that. I had my faith in humanity restored. I also learned what's the difference between my will and God's will. Yeah, that's a really difficult one, because mentally, we, especially Al-Anons, we are smart people. We're manipulative people. We know how to get our needs met. And I'm an adult child too, by the way, thank you. Right? We're survivors. Survivors are people who know how to get what they need, no matter what it takes, and you can rationalize anything. So it's really difficult to know what's your will and what's God's will. It takes an extra step. The conscious contact with God that I needed was much deeper than what most people in this program needs for me to know what God's will was. I can tell you, tonight, when I saw the line up here and I saw people speaking, those people know what God's will is for them. You can see it. They're living it. You could ask them. They could tell you right now. God's will is I'm doing chips right now, right? That's the way it is. God's will. But here's the doctorate degree on that stuff. I learned about God's will. How many of you have ever had to put down an animal, a pet, a cat, a dog? Yeah, all of us, right? Any of you who are those stewards of those creatures who you love, and it comes to the end of their life, there's a time that you know it's time to put the dog down. And you don't want to let it go. That is insight about what God's will is like. It's when you know at that level, because you love that creature so much, the last thing in the world you would ever do is cause it harm. But yet you steward that creature in that last act of love. I can see people almost brought to tears. I'm almost brought to tears. I've done 2 or 3 of these. But that's, to me, what God's will is like. It's like that. I'm going to watch my time here. Okay, I got a few minutes left. Okay, in the second 20 years, here's what I learned. I learned about fear. Here's what I learned about fear. I spent several years and I did a deep dive on fear on one weekend with a whole group of people just working on fear. Here's the simple fact. Don't accept it as advice. Think about it for yourself and see if it's true. Fear does not exist in the present moment. It's that simple. It is that simple. Fear always arises when I allow myself to think back or project forward. But when I'm in this present moment, even if the freaking bear is standing in front of me, I'm not in fear. I might be stunned like crap, but I am not in fear. The fear comes with the future. Oh, crap, the bear's going to eat me. That's the future, right? Or the past. Oh, shit, there's a bear. There was one here last week like that. That one's going to get me, right? But in this present moment, no fear. That's what I learned. That's the way it works. Detachment. I learned about detachment. Oh my God, it took like 20 years to learn detachment. How many of you are still working on detachment out there? All right, there you go. There you go. I rest my case. Me too. I am. Yeah. Here's the simple thing on detachment. Detachment is as simple as the story about the two coyotes. You know, the one good one, the one bad one, and they're both barking at you. Which one's going to win? It's the one you feed. Right? Detachment's that way. You feed it, you get it. You watch it, it doesn't like not getting attention. And if you don't give it attention, guess what? It will find another sucker in here to get attached to. It's what it does. And then you're going to be in here trying to help get some help from us. Don't feed it. That's what I learned about detachment. Okay, then, okay, now in the last 5 years, many people in a couple of the groups I go to, they've heard me talk about this. And I'm actually going to close pretty much with this because I am coming down to my time. I'm going to not let the bell go off because I want to feel like I actually honored my time frame here. that's just me. Here's what I have found. In the last 5 to 10 years, what I've been working on is who I am. Am I this ego personality, this body? Now, I'm lucky enough to have 60, almost 70 years on me at this point. And I am beginning to see, and I get those beautiful insights we all get when you are spiritually part of a community, where you go away and you suddenly are this collective consciousness and you're not you anymore. So you are this spiritual consciousness. You're not the body. I am you. You are me. We are this consciousness, which is a collective consciousness. It's not a separate consciousness. Now, this is very, very, very deep spiritual stuff, but it's also deep science stuff as well. Science is telling us this, that when the butterfly flaps its wings in Walnut Creek, there's a typhoon across the world. We are all interconnected. And on the spiritual plane, we are not only interconnected, I'm telling you, my observation has been, and what I'm learning from this group is the reason our stories resonate with each other is because we are each other. And then here's the final thing that I'm going to end with, because the men's group, thank you so much for asking me to speak. I wanted to share one thing, a couple things about the men's perspective on Al-Anon, and I thought the most unusual thing for a man to speak about in Al-Anon would be love. So here's what I think I'm going to do. I'm just going to cut to the chase with that so I can end. Here's what I learned about love from Al-Anon, from AA, from Narcanon, from OA, from all of the addiction treatments. Okay, here's what I found that we do in this program. We open our hearts and our minds and our souls without judgment or expectations to anyone. And you will find that consistently. I've been across the globe and I've been to AA, Al-Anon, I've been to 12-step meetings. You walk in one and you will be welcomed. It doesn't matter who you are, or what program you're working. You will be welcomed. There will be no expectation and you will not be judged. That's what we do. That's what love is. We make space for you. We let you be who you are, how you are, what you are, and exactly where you are at any time. And always, there's the program calls so that 24/7 you can reach out to someone and just be who you need to be in that moment. That's an amazing thing we do in this program. That's real love. Real love lets people be who they need to be, not who we want them to be. We don't wear our recovery as an achievement. When we are at our best, we live in a humility that we get collectively together. We understand your story because your story is my story. We all have good days. We got bad days. We got good years. We got good lives. We got tough lives. But no life working an authentic program is ever wasted. It does literally transform us. It heals. And even if it's a tragedy, all lives do serve a purpose, which is bigger than any of us and serves all of our higher powers. We don't get angry or frustrated with you. We offer you unconditional love and acceptance. You get to work your program one day at a time, whatever way works for you. And we learn from that experience strength and hope wherever you are when you show up and share with others. Most important part of this program, I think, is the sharing. And that's what Bill W. himself would tell you. It didn't stick until he found another alcoholic to talk to. That's the way it worked. If that last segment, I'm ending on this, sounded familiar, it's because it's biblical. It basically is Corinthians 13, another prayer, not from this program, but one from the Christian tradition, but often is used in this program. Many of you know this. It's said at weddings. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices in truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always preserves. Thank you, each and every one of you, for creating a safe space for us to do this work. God bless you all.